Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
October 24th, 1953 was a typical fall Friday night in La Crosse, Wisconsin. La Crosse State College was playing their homecoming game, and families and students were filling the stands. 15-year-old Evelyn Hartley was supposed to be at that game too, but at the last minute, she agreed to help a family friend and babysit their toddler so that the parents could go to the game themselves. She brought her school books and planned to spend the night studying after the baby went to bed. It was supposed to be a quiet evening and an opportunity for Evelyn to make some extra money. But when Evelyn's father tried to call her later that night and didn't get an answer, something didn't sit right with him. He got into his car and drove over to the house where she was babysitting. But what he found wasn't just unsettling. It was a scene that would spark one of the most intense missing persons investigations in Wisconsin history. One whose mystery endures over 70 years later. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Evelyn Hartley. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. So this, I think, is the oldest case that we've covered.
Is it? I feel like, who's the guy that had some... started his whole life
when Lawrence Bader. Yeah. You know, I think that was a few years later. I think that was the late 50s, and this was 53.
Okay. All right.
I think. If I'm remembering correctly, somebody can correct me. But this is an old one. But no matter how old, I think all of these stories are important to get out there. But this case is especially frustrating because I feel as though had it taken place more recently, and had police had the access to today's technology, I think this would have been solved. So it's kind of a bummer because of that. But again, there's always a chance. I mean, we've seen lately many old, old cases getting solved. So this very well could be one of them. But before we get into it, I want to give a special shout out to a few new folks who've joined us over on Patreon. Thank you to Rebecca U, Brianna R, Maura P, Ashley C, and Mary KW. Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much.
Your support means the world to us. And just a reminder, if you join us over on Patreon at any level, starting at just $2 a month, you can get ad-free episodes and a copy of the ebook that I wrote. So with that out of the way, let's get into the story of Evelyn Hartley. Evelyn Grace Hartley was born on November 21st, 1937 to Ethel and Richard Hartley. Sadly, tragedy hit the Hartley family early when one of her older brothers passed away from polio in 1946.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, it was just one of those things that thankfully is completely preventable now. 3 years later, the family relocated from Charleston, Illinois to La Crosse, Wisconsin. In 1953, Evelyn Hartley was a 15-year-old sophomore at Central High School. By all accounts, she was the kind of kid that any parent would be proud of. She was reliable, responsible, bright, and kind. She was a straight-A student and loved science. But she also participated in a variety of activities, including drama club. She played the piano, she was active in her church youth group, and she often helped out around the house without being asked.
I don't know what that's like.
Neither do I. Evelyn's father, Richard, was a biology professor at La Crosse State College, which is now known as the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He and Ethel were deeply involved in their community and well-liked by colleagues and neighbors alike. The Hartleys lived just a short walk from campus, and the family lived the idyllic 1950s suburban life that has been glorified in TV and movies for decades. I mean, can you imagine, like, you know, the dad's a college professor, you live within walking distance in this, like, cute little suburban town in Wisconsin, like, while you're participating in your church youth group and playing piano?
White picket fence.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, it is the definition of, like, the ideal suburban lifestyle, it sounds like. On the night of October 24th, 1953, Evelyn was supposed to attend the homecoming football game at the college. But at the last minute, she agreed to help a family friend by babysitting their 20-month-old daughter. Now, it wasn't her first time babysitting. She'd watched kids before, including children in the same neighborhood. The house was only a few blocks from her own, on the quiet south side of town. The parents, the Rasmussen family, were going to the football game. The father, Viggo Rasmussen, was a professor at the college and knew Evelyn's father. So it sounds like a lot of the staff was kind of expected to go to the game.
Oh, yeah. I guess that makes sense. I mean, especially in the 50s.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So I think, like, he wasn't initially planning on going, but then kind of at the last minute was like, oh, shoot, I think I do need to be there.
Yeah.
So their regular babysitter, like, already had plans. And so that's why Viggo asked Richard if Evelyn could help him out that night. And also, when I was researching this and I first saw the name Viggo Rasmussen, I was like, there's no way. Like, I had to, like, double check to make sure that was actually the name.
When you said it, I don't know whether you saw my face, like, yeah, kind of contort, because
I knew
it
you
does.
Would react
it's
to that.
Like, it does not sound like a real name.
I know. But what's really funny is that one of the articles I was reading about this, it was, like, written by some radio station. The poor person, whoever wrote this, and, you know, it was written years ago and has never been fixed, wrote Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah. So there is a source on this case out there that has Viggo Mortensen hiring this babysitter in La Crosse, Wisconsin in 1953.
Yeah, I don't think the timeline works out.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Now, this was supposed to be an uneventful evening. Evelyn's main plan was to put the baby to bed and then do some homework. It was an easy gig and honestly not the worst way for her to spend a Friday night. But of course, that's not what happened. By the end of that night, Evelyn Hartley would become the center of one of Wisconsin's most baffling missing persons cases. And over 70 years later, people are still asking the same question. What happened to Evelyn? October 24th started out as a completely unremarkable day. Evelyn went to school, came home, and got ready to babysit. Around 6:20 p.m., Evelyn changed clothes, grabbed her school books, and headed over to the Rasmussen home on Hochler Drive. She was wearing red jeans, white bobby socks, a white blouse, and a red and gray checked jacket. The Rasmussens left for the game around 6:30. Evelyn was left alone in the house with their toddler daughter. The little girl went to sleep a little bit later without issue, and Evelyn sat down to do some homework. But sometime between 7 and 8:30 p.m., something went terribly wrong. Evelyn's father, Richard Hartley, had asked Evelyn to call and check in with him. At around 8:30 p.m., when he hadn't yet heard from his daughter, he tried to call the Rasmussen house to check in on her. It was just a simple call, like a quick, hey, is everything okay, you know, type of check-in. But Evelyn didn't answer. He tried again a few minutes later, but still no answer. That's when Richard began to worry. He knew his daughter, Evelyn, was incredibly responsible. There was no reason for her to, one, not call like her father asked her to, and two, not answer when he called. So, you know, he was trying to look for explanations, and he was just hoping, okay, maybe the baby's fussy or whatever, and she was having trouble putting her to bed, you know, and that's why she couldn't call or answer the phone.
Just for clarification purposes, was this the first time that he called her? Like, so you said that the family left at 6:30.
Yeah.
And then she put the baby down around 7. How do we know that?
We don't know that she put the baby down around 7. I mean, it was sometime around then, but she was supposed to call her dad by 8:30, and she didn't call, so he called her.
Right. But so last time anybody saw her was 6:30.
Yeah, 6:30, 6:45. Yeah, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Her and the baby.
Her and the baby, correct.
Okay.
So even though he was trying to find innocent explanations, deep down he feared that there was more to it. So Richard, instead of just sitting at home and wondering, got into his car and drove the few blocks to Hoechsler Drive to see for himself. When he got there around 9:20 p.m., the house looked normal, at least at first glance. The lights were on and the radio was playing softly, but no one answered the door. He tried knocking again. Still nothing. Then he walked around the side of the house and looked through the windows. And that's when he saw it. One of Evelyn's shoes and her glasses, which were broken, were on the living room floor.
Sign of a struggle.
Mm-hmm. Now, fully panicked, Richard found a basement window that had been left open. A screen had been removed and was left lying nearby. Under the window, a stepladder was propped up. He crawled inside. And this confused me because I kept on reading that the stepladder was propped up, you know, against the window. And that made it seem like whoever the intruder was had used that outside.
Yeah.
But I saw a crime scene photo and it looks like the ladder was actually on the inside of the window.
Okay.
From what it looks like, just from the one picture that I could see, the window was large enough, obviously, for a person to, you know, get through, right?
And you said this is a basement window?
It's a basement window. So the window, though, was close to the ground outside.
Right.
From what it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem as though you would have needed the ladder on the outside to get in, but it was a far drop inside. What I read in one source was that the ladder, the stepladder, was actually set up by the Rasmussen family earlier because they were painting.
Okay. But the screen was
out.
Pushed out mm-hmm. on the outside of the house.
I believe it was on the outside of the house, yes.
Okay.
But it was removed from the window.
Yeah.
So once Richard crawled inside, what he found was every parent's worst nightmare. Evelyn was gone. Thankfully, though, the baby was still asleep in her crib upstairs, completely unharmed.
Whoa. I thought for sure this was going to be like, baby and Evelyn were gone.
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, baby was just snoozing.
Okay, I'll let you keep going because I have questions.
While, you know, the baby was fine, everything in the baby's room was fine, there were signs of a struggle throughout the rest of the house. Furniture was out of place, and blood was found in several rooms, including the living room, the basement stairs, and even pooled outside in the yard. Evelyn's other shoe was found in the basement, so the one was in the living room. Her school books had been knocked over, discarded, you know, again, on the main level. Definitely not where Evelyn would have put them.
Mm-hmm.
While this is all going on, one of the neighbors came over because they saw this strange man sneaking into the house.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Richard talked to the neighbor, told the neighbor what was going on, and then they went and called 911. When police arrived, the scene was suspicious enough that they immediately launched a full-scale investigation. They didn't waste any time thinking that maybe Evelyn had just decided to, you know, put the baby to bed and like run off with a boyfriend or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
As investigators examined the home, they discovered pry marks on several windows, suggesting that someone had tried maybe multiple times to get into the house before finding the open basement window, just as Evelyn's father had.
That was one of the questions I had, was if there was any sign of forced entry.
Yep.
Okay.
In addition to the blood in the yard, a bloody handprint was found on a garage. And it's been, again, it's unclear from the sources if this was their detached garage or if it was a neighbor's garage. But in any case, it was about 100 feet from the house.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was also blood on a neighbor's house. A button with red fabric attached was found near the basement window, which indicated that Evelyn may have been carried out of that window because, remember, she was wearing red denim pants.
Mm-hmm.
But she also could have been taken out the front door because that door automatically locked when it was closed. Because, you know, obviously the door was locked when yeah. Richard got there.
Right.
But given the blood outside, it seems far more likely that she was taken out of the back of the house. Oh, and that button, police apparently didn't take it in as evidence, and it eventually, like, blew away.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, was it the main button of her pants?
I didn't see anything that said specifically, but that's what I would guess, because they were jeans, and so I would guess it was just the top, you know, the top button.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I didn't see anything that said specifically.
That's worrying, though.
Yeah, for sure. Interviewing the neighbors yielded some helpful information, but not a ton. One neighbor reported hearing a scream around 7:15 p.m., but dismissed it at the time, thinking that it might have come from someone at the homecoming game. Because remember, this whole neighborhood is like right by the college.
Yeah.
Another said that they had seen a light-colored vehicle circling around the neighborhood at around 8 p.m., which fit with another piece of evidence. Tracking dogs were brought in, and they were able to follow Evelyn's scent for about two blocks before it disappeared, likely into a waiting car.
Mm-hmm.
The search for Evelyn quickly grew into one of the largest in state history. Within a week, over 2,000 volunteers had joined in. Some were National Guardsmen, others were students from La Crosse State College, and many were just locals who couldn't believe that something like this had happened in their town. They canvassed neighborhoods, combed fields and riverbanks, and searched every possible hiding place within a 50-mile radius. Planes flew overhead, scanning for signs of freshly disturbed ground. Boats patrolled the Mississippi River. Divers were brought in to search wells and ponds. The local Red Cross organized food and shelter for the volunteers, and farmers showed up with tractors and floodlights. People dropped what they were doing and joined in. But there was no sign of Evelyn. And then the discovery started. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that are delivered discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off with your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. They have so many different types of gummies. It's absolutely wild. Their sleepy time gummies will knock you out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers and no grogginess. You will wake up feeling amazing. They even have gummies for pain relief. And I have some that I'm going to give to a relative who has hip problems but can't take ibuprofen for other health reasons. And their Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything: immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small family-owned American farms. I want to stress this one more time. This is federally legal. There are no pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Hey, it's Kona, and April is Earth Month. Did you know that most mattresses end up in landfills within a decade? That's why quality is sustainability. Avocado Green mattresses are built to last. They're crafted with non-toxic, certified organic materials and made in their own zero-waste factory. They've already diverted 85% of waste from landfills, and they're working toward even more. And as a 1% Planet member, Avocado donates at least 1% of all revenue to environmental nonprofits tackling climate change, restoring ecosystems, and protecting our planet. That means every time you choose Avocado, you're directly supporting organizations making a real impact. A better night's sleep and a better planet? That's a win-win. You can even have a sleep trial up to 1 year and generous warranties for your peace of mind. So head to avocadomattress.com today and save up to 10% on certified organic mattresses. Dream of better for you and the planet. First, a pair of underwear and a bra believed to be Evelyn's were found near an underpass along Highway 14, 2 miles south of La Crosse. They were believed to belong to Evelyn because the underwear had menstrual blood on it that matched her blood type. Then, 4 miles farther down the road, a pair of men's pants was recovered, also with blood on them, though it doesn't seem as though investigators collected them because they weren't sure if it was related.
Jesus.
And I've seen conflicting reports on these pants. Some say that they did collect them and typed the blood and, you know, it was Evelyn's blood type as well. But I've read other reports that seem to indicate that they didn't collect them or test them.
Mm.
So I'm not 100% sure on that. But either way, it doesn't seem as though those pants are available any longer. However, a few days later, even more items were discovered that investigators did seem to think belonged to the perpetrator. A pair of size 11 Goodrich sneakers and a size 36 denim jacket found near Coon Valley, several miles southeast of town. Now, this was a huge breakthrough because when police were initially investigating at the house, they saw footprints outside of that basement window that didn't match Richard's shoes or, you know, the neighbor who came over. And they were kind of weird. They had like almost a suction cup like pattern on the bottom.
Hmm.
So they really stood out. And these shoes that were found looked to have the same pattern.
Hmm.
It's also incredibly frustrating, though, because the jacket was found to have sweat stains underneath the armpits. In 1953, that meant very little other than the owner probably wore it a lot.
Right. But if it existed in evidence today, they could potentially get DNA from it.
Exactly. So as soon as I read that, I was just like, I was just shaking my head. I was like, oh my gosh, they could have had them right there.
Yeah. Did they keep that evidence? I mean, I understand it's 70 plus years ago, but.
No.
Hmm.
The jacket and the shoes have apparently been lost. Now, one thing that was interesting is that after examining the size of the shoes versus the size of the jacket, which, like I said, was a 36, investigators believed that they didn't belong to the same person. Basically, they thought that the jacket was too small for someone with size 11 shoes.
Okay.
Yeah, listen, it's not the most scientific finding in the world, but if true, it could indicate that there were two suspects, which does make sense given what we do know about the case. Because remember those pools of blood on the lawn?
Yeah.
It's theorized that the person who carried Evelyn out of the house had to stop and rest. So he put her down on the lawn, causing those pools of blood.
Mm.
He then picked her up and carried her to the car, which very well could have had a driver waiting inside.
Yeah, or not.
While DNA wasn't an option on this case, La Crosse police took full advantage of the resources that were available to them. They attempted to polygraph every male student and teacher at Evelyn's high school.
Whoa, how many people was that?
I think it was over 1,000.
Jesus.
Yeah, they got through about 300 before they were shut down.
Yeah, wow, that's ambitious.
I know. But of those 300, no one failed the test in a way that raised a red flag. And even the Rasmussen family was thoroughly questioned, though police quickly determined that they had no involvement. They had been at the football game, surrounded by witnesses, and were completely cooperative with the investigation. Despite the massive response, investigators were stuck. There were no eyewitnesses to the abduction, and no fingerprints were found in or around the house. And the no eyewitnesses thing I find really interesting, because that neighbor came over when Richard was creeping around the house.
Right.
But somehow they missed the entire abduction of Evelyn.
Yeah. That seems odd.
Yeah, I agree. That was really surprising to me.
But on the other hand, the abduction, in theory, took place around 7:15. Mm-hmm. That's when people are eating dinner.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, maybe they were just busy doing other things.
And Richard didn't get there until
after 9.
Right.
And so when you see somebody, you know, maybe that's when you're relaxing in the living room and then you see somebody creeping around your neighbor's house.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it is a little bit more noticeable then.
Maybe.
But I still just found it odd. Despite a massive search effort, thousands of interviews, and physical evidence left behind, Evelyn Hartley's abductor, or abductors, were never identified. Over the years, a number of theories have emerged. Some are rooted in actual investigation, while others are based more in rumor or hindsight. But they all share one thing in common. None have ever led to an arrest. Shortly after Evelyn disappeared, police questioned a local teenage boy who had been reported for peeping into windows in the neighborhood. He was known to be a bit of a loner, and while his behavior raised eyebrows, there was no physical evidence linking him to Evelyn's disappearance.
What size shoe did he wear?
It doesn't say, but it didn't match the size of the shoe. And he passed a polygraph. Oh, and also, the jacket was very much a workman's jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And they found in the pocket some sort of a steel brush. I forget what industry it was linked to, but it was very much the jacket of, an adult, you know, not the jacket of a high school kid.
A steel brush like something a mechanic would have?
Yeah, I think something along those lines.
Okay. The Rasmussens only had the one daughter.
No, so it actually turns out that they had a 7-year-old daughter as well, but she went to the game with them.
Okay. So the reason why I was asking, you know, how did this guy pick this house this night? Right. So my first thought was if they had a teenage daughter who in theory could have been left alone in the house, that he had been stalking that daughter.
Yeah.
The only thing that I can think of is that he was casing the neighborhood and saw Evelyn.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's interesting because the children thing was another aspect of this that was kind of hard to figure out, because I read one source initially, one of the very first things that I read said that it was the Rasmussen's teenage daughter who normally babysat, but she had plans. And so that's what they called Evelyn. So then I was reading things that indicated they didn't have a teenage daughter and that it was just just some other random teenager who usually babysat for them. Yeah. So I was kind of confused on that. But as it turns out, there was a 7-year-old daughter named Lena and her little sister, Janice, who was the baby that Evelyn was babysitting that night.
I'm just wondering or theorizing, I guess, how, why this house?
Why that house? Yeah.
Right. Because there's nothing, this isn't like a normal engagement for her, right? It's not something that she normally does.
I don't
think
she'd ever babysat for them before.
So
And it doesn't sound like, you know, the other babysitter babysat often enough that somebody would be stalking her.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It didn't seem like it was a regular Friday night gig or anything like that. And it was just Evelyn instead of this other girl.
And you would think that if he was going and looking through windows around the neighborhood, somebody would have seen him.
Right.
You know, because it's Wisconsin at 7 o'clock or whatever, but it's not that dark. It's not that late. You know?
Right. Exactly. It's interesting, too, because it's if you were looking to perform a robbery, that neighborhood, that time would make sense because a lot of people, I'm sure, were gone at the homecoming game.
Sure.
But if you're looking to abduct a teenage girl, then this is a terrible time because most of the teenage girls are at the homecoming game, you know?
Unless he saw her go into that house and was basically casing, I mean, saw her and was casing her, following her.
Yeah.
And then saw that the adults left.
Right. Yeah. It could just be that. So in the weeks following Evelyn's disappearance, other neighbors reported seeing men lurking near their homes at night. But, I mean, I think that's more of just the entire town being that's on
paranoia.
Edge.
Paranoia.
Yeah. Yeah. And whether any of those prowlers were actually connected to Evelyn's case or were simply the result of mass paranoia, as you said, it's just something we'll probably never know. Police also explored the idea that Evelyn may have interrupted a burglary, kind of like what we were just saying, because pry marks were found on several windows, which, again, right. You would expect to see if somebody was just trying to
break into the house.
Yeah. Now, it is possible that the person thought the house was empty only to discover Evelyn inside. And in that scenario, she may have been taken to prevent her from identifying the intruder.
Seems like a lot of work, though.
Yeah, exactly. Because if it was a burglary gone wrong, why go through the trouble of abducting a teenager when most burglars would just run away once they realized somebody was home?
Right. And there's also, I have to bring this up, I mean, there's evidence of rape.
Yeah.
Which
is generally isn't how you're going to pivot right. If you're just looking to steal, like, some jewelry or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's important to note that nothing was missing from the home.
There's that, too.
In 1970, nearly two decades after Evelyn vanished, police received a letter from an inmate in a Wisconsin prison. He claimed that he had information about Evelyn's disappearance. Not just information. He said that he had been there. According to this man, he and a group of others had taken Evelyn, assaulted her, and then killed her. He said her body had been disposed of in a septic tank somewhere outside La Crosse. He even provided names. Now, police apparently investigated this, you know, found the people who are named, interviewed them, and searched several locations, including old septic tanks and abandoned farm properties. But they didn't find anything. No remains, no physical evidence, and no confirmation that this man was telling the truth. Some believe that he fabricated the story to gain favor with authorities or to feel important. Others think there may have been a kernel of truth in what he said, but not enough to find answers. Either way, this confession never led anywhere. But of course, no list of mid-century Wisconsin horror stories would be complete without the name Ed Gein. For those of you who may be unfamiliar, Ed Gein was a local serial killer who was operating in Wisconsin around this time. Gein was arrested in November 1957, 4 years after Evelyn disappeared, for the murder of a local hardware store owner named Bernice Warden in Plainfield, Wisconsin. When investigators searched Gein's farmhouse, what they found was not at all what they were expecting. They found furniture made from human remains, clothing sewn from skin, and parts of at least 15 different people. Gein admitted to two murders, Bernice Warden and a tavern owner named Mary Hogan, and to robbing numerous graves. And Gein is, of course, partially what the character Buffalo Bill is based on from Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
After his arrest, law enforcement began re-examining cold cases across Wisconsin. Evelyn's name quickly resurfaced. One reason is that rumors had circulated that Gein may have had relatives living near the Rasmussen home, close to the area where Evelyn was last seen. Some locals claimed that he had visited the La Crosse area in the early 1950s, possibly around the time Evelyn went missing. This was such a big rumor that I've literally seen sources that said he was visiting family two blocks away on the night that Evelyn disappeared.
I mean, that's verifiable, though. Right?
Yeah, and like, I don't think it's actually true at all. Because when investigators looked deeper, they found no evidence that Gein had actually been in La Crosse on that particular weekend. He didn't drive, and his movements were largely confined to the area surrounding his family's farm in Plainfield, which was about 150 miles away. Despite the rumors, no official report or witness placed him near Hochler Drive in October 1953. So while the Gein theory is often mentioned in stories about Evelyn's case, it's been largely disproven. But I had to mention it because it does come up, like, in everything.
Sure, yeah.
After such an intensive search in the bloody clothes, it seems almost impossible that Evelyn was never found. But that's exactly what happened. And as you can imagine, it left her family absolutely devastated. Two of the four Hartley children were now dead. Evelyn's father, Richard Hartley, who had discovered the empty house, was never quite the same. He had been a respected biology professor. He was logical and grounded in science, but Evelyn's disappearance was something he couldn't reason his way through. In interviews over the years, he maintained a calm demeanor, but friends said he carried a weight that never lifted. Her mother, Ethel, rarely spoke publicly, but remained deeply involved in keeping Evelyn's name in the press. The family held out hope even as the years dragged on. In the decades that followed, Richard continued to cooperate with every new wave of investigators. Every time a lead surfaced, every time someone claimed to know something, he picked up the phone. But the answers never came. Evelyn's case became kind of a ghost story in La Crosse, not in the supernatural sense, but in the way that tragedies sometimes haunt entire towns. People who had been children at the time grew up remembering the search parties, the helicopters, and the locked doors that hadn't been locked before. And the Rasmussens were also never the same, especially Viggo. As a father himself of two younger girls,
right?
Like, he apparently just completely lost it, according to his daughter, who was seven at the time. He loved that house, but he immediately put it up for sale. Like,
well, yeah, I can definitely understand that.
Could not stay there anymore. They bought another house, you know, in town, and he put bars on all of the windows.
Jeez.
Janice Rasmussen, the toddler who Evelyn had been babysitting that night, did say that her family was changed after that. Growing up, you know, despite the moving and the bars on the windows, which she was too young to remember any of that, she said her parents never spoke about what happened that night, and she only found out after reading a newspaper article about it.
Oh my God, I wonder how old she was.
Yeah, it didn't say, but I mean, old enough to be reading the newspaper. Yeah. So like, she had no idea that she was the baby who was there that night.
Holy shit, that must have been like so mind-blowing for
her. I know.
Also, that's like very, very stereotypical 1950s behavior.
Oh yeah, like, don't talk about it.
Let's just not talk about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even her older sister apparently never mentioned it.
Yeah. And
she remembered everything.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, she's suffering from some level of trauma or PTSD because of it also.
Oh, absolutely. And because she was old enough. And she said that was the first time she had ever seen adults cry.
Yeah. And that, just put it out of your mind. Don't talk about it.
Yeah. And so, you know, like I said, so Janice was obviously too young, you know, for that part of it. But she did say in a much later interview that her parents never let her and her sister babysit growing up.
Yeah, that's fair.
Over the years, local newspapers would run stories on the anniversary of Evelyn's disappearance. Reporters would visit the police department, flip through the thick case file, and talk to investigators who had inherited the case long after the original detectives had retired or passed away. Even in the 1980s and 90s, new police chiefs would come forward saying they wanted to give the case another look. Advances in forensic science gave people brief hope. Maybe there was DNA on the window screen or touch evidence on her clothes. But every test ended in the same place. No match. No resolution. And unfortunately, like I mentioned before, they no longer have the shoes or the jacket belonging to the perpetrator or perpetrators. But again, it sounds like they do still have Evelyn's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
So with the advancements in DNA, especially genetic genealogy,
right?
If those are still in good enough shape to be retested, because I don't know when the last time they were actually tested was.
Yeah.
If they're still in good enough shape to be retested, we could still get something off of it. And genetic genealogy could truly hold the answer to this case, even though it's been over 70 years. Evelyn Hartley's case changed how missing persons investigations were handled in Wisconsin. At the time, there were few standardized protocols for child abductions. After Evelyn vanished, police departments around the state began creating more formal processes for search efforts, evidence collection, and community alerts. There's no one still alive who believes that Evelyn ran away. The most widely accepted belief is that Evelyn was abducted and likely murdered that same night in 1953. And yet, no body has ever been found. No one has ever been arrested, and no one has ever confessed in a way that held up to scrutiny. She is, by all definitions, still missing. So what happened to Evelyn Hartley? Did someone target her specifically? Was it a crime of opportunity? Did she know her attacker, or did a complete stranger take her in the dark? Today, there are still detectives who remember her case. There are still townspeople who grew up with her photo on the bulletin boards. And there are still people who leave flowers for a girl they never knew because they haven't forgotten her story. And neither should we. Evelyn Hartley has been missing from La Crosse, Wisconsin since October 24th, 1953. She was approximately 5'7" and weighed around 125 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She had light brown hair and blue eyes. Evelyn was 15 when she went missing. She would be 87 today. Anyone with any information about Evelyn Hartley's disappearance is urged to call the La Crosse Police Department at 608-785-5962. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.